get your thing going?
Dude, I'm ready. I recorded two voice promos.
Really?
I'm ready to go.
Alright. Whoa. Then, hold on. 1 second. Sorry.
God damn it.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again, co-host Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
That's right, I'm back, Foster Kids. With me from Los Angeles is Cassidy Robinson.
Last weekend was your birthday.
Yeah, a lot's happened since I last spoke. I went to an improv camp. Mm-hmm. I lost my voice and got sick by drunkenly karaokeing Creed until the wee hours of the morning. To the point where I lost my voice, to the point where I got kind of sick. Then I got better. Then it was my birthday. Ashley took me to a nice dinner at a very fancy seafood place. Mm-hmm. Then we went and saw Blade Runner. And then the next day we went to Universal Studios for Halloween Horror Nights.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever been to that?
No, I keep meaning to. I might do it sometime this month.
You should have gone with us, because it's a good time. They design the haunted houses based off of movies, so most of them are like you're walking through the movie, but with like jump scares.
Right.
I do think it was better last year. I just think they had a better theme overall. This year it felt a little scattered. Like last year it was The Purge and Demented Clowns had like taken over the park, and it felt kind of scattered this year. Like their big thing was the Titans of Terror. So it was Freddy Krueger, Jason, Chucky, Leatherface, and it wasn't as cohesive a theme. But there was one of the haunted houses was a Saw haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was genuinely pretty freaky. Like that was really well done. There was one room that we walked into. It was like a bathroom, like from the first movie, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
There were like, you know, people chained to the walls and stuff.
And then they chained you to a wall and told you you couldn't leave until you chopped your arm off.
Yeah. Yeah. I only have one arm now. No, pretty that crazy. Room, like, smelled really bad, like, to the point where it almost made Ashley gag.
Mm.
And then we go through, and there's, like, a room where there's bodies hanging from chains, and you have to, like, walk past them. But if you walk too close to the walls, there are, like, fake razor blades that came out, like saw blades. It was pretty freaky.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of haunted house I prefer, is more the thematic. Like, oh, this is fucked up and creative versus
somebody popping out and booing you.
Yeah, which, I mean, there's definitely a lot of that there, too. But I like that each one is sort of just a movie universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they did a Shining one this year that was pretty fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I've been challenging myself this month to try and watch a bunch of horror movies I've never seen before, like my list of shame, try and go through that a little bit.
Sure.
My original challenge was to do 31, like go every day of the week, which is just way too impossible.
Yeah, that's insane.
Like,
nobody has that time.
I was going to try and carve out the time, but then I realized that's not going to happen. There's just too many nights like this one, where by the end time we're done with this, I'm not going to really want to watch something. But I did manage to crack a few. I watched the first Blair Witch, which I'd never seen before.
Yeah, I saw that.
And it's like, it is what it is. Like, it's so quaint now because it's been copied to death.
Sure.
But there's something about it that's a lot more sort of pure in its ideas. Like, it's not in the conceit of the found footage thing. It's nowadays when you watch a found footage film, it's just shot like found footage, but there's still like mm-hmm. normal coverage and all these angles and the multiple cameras. You're like, who the hell is holding all these cameras? Who the hell's editing all this?
Yeah.
So it ruins the conceit for me, but that one is like a lot more pure. I'd say it's worth seeing. It's not very scary, though. And then I watched Motel Hell, which is like a Texas Chainsaw ripoff from 1980.
Okay.
But it is crazy. I super recommend that one. That is, because it's kind of like a horror comedy, but I'm not so sure if it was trying to be a comedy. But then I was sure. Like, it felt like John Waters doing a Texas Chainsaw ripoff.
Oh, all right.
Like, I mean, Divine could have been in that movie very easily.
Cool.
And so it has a kind of like a Pink Flamingos, but with gore. And then I watched The Howling for the first time. I've never seen The Howling, Joe Dante's werewolf movie.
Oh, you know, I haven't either.
It doesn't date very well. I'm going to say, of all the ones I've seen, even Blair Witch, which you think would date the worst, No, that one, there's a reason I think people mostly talk about Werewolf in London, which came out around the same time. It was definitely the superior werewolf movie of that year. Although I do like the idea of, like, setting a werewolf film in the middle of, like, a hippie commune swingers community. Like, that was kind of inspired, but yeah, mostly doesn't date very well. And then, of mm-hmm. course, I watch Baskin, which we'll be talking about as our Netflix review.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been kind of doing it. Going for it.
I'm doing it. And I got a list for this week, too. We'll see if I get to it.
All right.
Last thing I wanted to bring up at the top of the show before we jump into our movie news, and we are going to be reviewing the Blade Runner 2049?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is you posted a thing, which we actually got a decent amount of response on, just asking people what their favorite horror movie was. Maybe we'll have more of these kind of little surveys or whatever.
Yeah, we gotta get the listeners to engage.
Yeah, I like it. Edgar from Portland, he's a friend of Richard's, he posted a picture of The Innocents that's on the Criterion Collection. Haven't seen mm-hmm. it. Maybe I'll put that on my list this month. Brandon Hall, who was our professor back in ISU,
That Brandon Hall?
Yeah, he was the guy who taught our film class.
Oh, I thought it was a different Brandon Hall.
I didn't know any other Brandon Halls, but...
Who am I thinking of that was Richard's friend?
I have zero idea.
Brandon Hill.
Yes.
I'm thinking of Brandon Hill. That makes so much more sense.
Right.
I was, like, really impressed with his rebuttal to your shocking statement about Day of the Dead versus Dawn of the Dead. I was like... Wow, I didn't know Brandon Hall was that. Brandon Hill. God damn it. You can see my confusion.
I can see your confusion. It's very funny to me, but it's not going to be funny to anybody else except for maybe Richard.
No. No, you know who Brandon Hill is, though.
Yes, so I do. But yeah, so Brandon Hall, our old film studies professor, 101 in ISU.
He said it makes me really happy.
It's an unbreakable tie between Evil Dead 2 and Texas Chainsaw from 1974. Ashley tried to get away with Hocus Pocus until you chastised her.
Okay, first of all, I did not chastise her. I just called her out. There's a difference. Second of all, why do you gotta out me like that? For some reason, whenever I post to the Facebook page, it posts as the Jabber and the Drone. I don't know how to not do that.
There's a tab. I'll show you at some point. Or you could just put, like, in brackets before your comment, Keith, or something like that, if you really care.
I kind of like just speaking for the podcast.
Right, yeah. But she said The Shining, It, or Hitchcock movies. You know, some of those are horror films.
Yeah, I guess we'll need clarification from her. Is it the new It or the 1990 It?
I'm pretty sure it's the new It. Katie Holverson, she posted a picture from Scream, so I'm assuming she meant Scream.
It's not a picture, it's a GIF.
A GIF?
It's a GIF.
A GIF. And Emily Climes, who's a friend of yours, I believe, said Jacob's Ladder, good pick.
Yes, that is a really good one. That's one of my favorites, too. Mm-hmm. So
that movie might come up in our Baskin conversation. And Leland from Olympia, Washington, of the old Damper cast, he posted Big List, Audition, Pulse, Evil Dead 2 again, and the original Halloween. I've never seen Pulse. It was one of those J-horrors.
Yeah, I'm not into that style, but I get it. I mean, it's very popular.
I mean, you know, there's some of those ones from, like, the original Japanese that I'd be interested in seeing Ju-on, not so much The Grudge, but whatever. And I might see the original Pulse at some point, or The Eye.
So, thank you, listeners, for answering the question. Yeah. I hope you had a little bit of fun with that.
Yeah, we'll try and post more of
those
in between shows.
Although, really, I mean, there's only the one answer is Evil Dead 2. It got two noms.
Yeah, so. I mean, I guess if you're taking a survey, that would be the winner. That wouldn't be mine.
Sorry,
but
Brandon Hall, we broke your unbreakable tie.
Not Brandon Hill. All right.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
So some of these are kind of goofy. Let's start with this one. Brett Ratner cast Jared Leto as Hugh Hefner in a biopic. Of course, Hugh Hefner just recently passed away, the owner and creator of Playboy magazine and, you know, rich mogul in Smoking Jacket.
The poster child for rich playboys.
Mm-hmm, like, literally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Opinions? Brett Ratner? Jared Leto?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a huge Brett Ratner fan. I don't know.
Not a lot of people are.
Yeah. I doubt he's going to make a Playboy movie with any teeth, but I don't know if it really needs that. I don't know. Like, Playboy, even though it featured nudity, was always a bit classier than, you know, a lot of the other, like, Hustler and stuff.
Right.
Like they held themselves to a certain standard. So I could see, like, a Hollywood version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Brett Ratner's a fine enough choice. I mean, he's going to make a very safe movie, I think.
Yeah, I think, and that's the problem. I actually think that safe is not the direct. This is kind of like the Queen biopic, where they originally wanted Sacha Baron Cohen, and then he dropped out because they weren't going to even touch the AIDS subject. It's like, well, then what the fuck movie are you making?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, if you're not doing, and I'm not saying that, like, a Playboy movie has to be so, you know, it doesn't have to be Boogie Nights.
But yeah.
It does. I think that there is a inherent kind of misogyny and stuff you have to kind of go into. I mean, it's a well-known, the mansion is well-known for having these debaucherous parties all the time with celebrities. Like, I don't know. I want to know the angle. But yeah, I assume.
Well, like, you didn't have me at Brett Ratner, and we will get into my feelings about Jared Leto.
The real J-Lit, yeah.
Yeah, once we get into Blade Runner. But I'm not super stoked whenever I hear his name attached to any project.
You have residual Joker beef.
Again, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I guess,
but
we are.
Yeah. Moving on.
Moving on. Gore Verbinski to maybe direct to the Gambit movie with Channing Tatum still attached. You know, I thought it was funny they announced this Gambit movie like forever ago, and then Channing Tatum was attached. And I thought at the time he was like kind of everywhere, and I was like, ugh, that's kind of obvious, and I don't know, can he really do the accent and blah blah blah. And then he wasn't in it anymore because the project I think was dead in the water for a little while, and I saw him in The Hateful Eight doing a very good Creole accent, and I was like, oh, well, maybe that would have been good. So I'm kind of into the idea now, more so than I was in whatever it was, 2013. And Gore Verbinski is, he's kind of a hit or miss director. Sometimes I think he's a little too overindulgent in his set pieces and direction over style. But I don't know.
I'm a little cynical about any X-Men news.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just because I kind of think maybe just leave it at Logan, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, I think Channing Tatum's a good choice. I think, honestly, I appreciate his attachment to the project more than anything. Like, it sort of feels like he's doing for Gambit whatever Ryan Reynolds did for Deadpool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he seems to genuinely care about the character and hopefully the end product. I don't think Gambit's the kind of character who can carry a movie. Like, he can't even really carry his own comic book title.
Right.
That aspect has me a little stumped. But I don't know.
You know what though? I think this is one of those instances where the interest in the character from the regular movie going public and the comic book reading public is going to make a difference. I think the regular movie-going public is a lot more into Gambit than, like, your hardcore comic geeks, who kind of understand that he's a gimmick character.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. And,
because they're going to be like, oh, I loved playing Gambit in Marvel vs. Capcom.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, ultimately, I think it's just going to come down to if they can make a good movie out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and if it could be like a standalone thing, kind of like Logan, I'd be a lot more into it. What I have issues with, what I kind of have hesitancy with anything in this X-Men clusterverse, is like, how much does it have to tie into the other X-Men movies? You know, like,
right.
Can I watch it and ignore the fact that two different people have played Emma Frost at two different ages and, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Two different time periods. If I can go to it and just enjoy a fun adventure with Channing Tatum being charming and blowing stuff off of his hands, I'd be a lot more into it. Also, with him playing this character, he had damn well better sing Country Road, Take Me Home.
At some point.
That's his new theme song. It has to come up.
Yeah. His Country Road trilogy.
Yes.
Do we want to get into the Harvey Weinstein news?
I think we have to at least bring it up something. Because this is a movie podcast and this is like huge industry movie news.
Right.
And
big news in general. Like I said, this has really been, as far as my Facebook feed and my Twitter and granted, I follow a lot of movie sites.
Yeah. Well, it's like the one not Trump-related story, not Rick and Morty's Szechuan sauce-related news event happening right now. So
we're beating around the bush. Harvey Weinstein, one of the co-founders of both Miramax and the Weinstein Company, has recently been outed by several victims.
And fired.
And
fired by the Weinstein Company.
Yeah, for sexual abuse and sexual misconduct with a lot of different actresses, employees, other producers, people who worked with him throughout the years. And it's one of those things like the Bill Cosby thing where once one or two people came out, then it just snowballed and more and more and more. And it's still coming out.
To the point where it's pretty damning. When one person comes out, they should be taken seriously, and very often they're not. And it's unfortunate that it does take 27 women's voices to actually get people digging into the things like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a bummer because I think the Weinstein Company has produced some great movies. And the story, and that's not a defense by any measure. And I think the story is getting murkier and murkier because now there's the whole thing about Matt Damon. And so far, that's sort of a non-story to me. I don't think there's enough real evidence there.
Well, Yeah, I guess what gets murky about it is this pattern of abuse
that's been going on it's like,
for so long, and he's so famous, and he's worked with so many people very, very closely.
And that, how many people have known and not said anything?
Yeah, like, something that outrageous does not just stay in those rooms. Like, I think this is stuff that people probably knew, but it was one of those things where it's like, well, you know, he's super powerful, and he's super rich, and he has, like, the ability to call people off on projects and put people on projects and cast people directly.
And what's good about this, though, so far I believe all the allegations, sure. You know, it's bad enough for them.
He didn't deny it. Like, there's no reason not to believe it. His excuse was, I'm from the 70s, and it was a different time, and I learned about how to deal with these things differently.
Yeah.
That was his excuse. That's not even a denial.
And that behavior is inexcusable. And on one hand, it is nice that we are seeing, you know, that someone like Harvey Weinstein isn't untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's fired. He's done. Hopefully it sticks. Hopefully he is done, because he shouldn't have power. He shouldn't have influence. How he's being dragged down for it, and the president got away with it. I don't know, but we're not going to go there. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that there is a cycle of men in power who are able to take advantage of people. And
I've been here in Los Angeles for a little while, and I'm, you know, industry adjacent. And the thing that people don't realize who aren't here and who don't, like, know people who work in it and things like that is, like, you know, they see things like the Christian Bale freakout tape, and they're like, oh, you know, they're clutching their pearls. Oh, my stars and garters. How could somebody talk like that to somebody on set? What a maniac. Mm-hmm. The reality is, that's every day on set all day. And the more powerful you are, the more people behave like that. There's the fact that any movie comes out at all is totally amazing. When any of them are good is a damn near miracle. Because there really isn't that much structure to making movies. There's lots of money that goes into it, but really, it's every single day, it's a bunch of people being barked at from one manager to another manager from another manager.
Well, that's true. But
there's a respect issue in general around here. But
I mean, you know, and I think it's easy for people to write this off as everyday business, and sexual abuse is very different than people screaming at you. You know what I mean?
No, I understand. I'm not trying to conflate the two. All I'm saying is that there's not much of, like, a normal business structure when it comes to, like, well, there's an HR department and you talk to them. Yes. And, like, those things kind of exist. But the reality is, it's really just a hierarchy of power. And the more powerful you are, the more you get away with. Mm-hmm. And that's just true in all circumstances, especially governmental. These stories aren't rare, and they should be a lot more rare. And, you know, the fact that somebody like a Harvey Weinstein comes down, or even Roger Ailes from a few months back.
Well, what's it? What's
this is something that needs to be more common, so that people have incentive.
You mean it coming out
that people are outed, and that people come out and talk about it and don't let it happen for fear of getting fired.
Yes. 100%. And more power to the women who have come forward and risked their careers. I don't even know all of the ones who have, and just kudos to them for coming out. And I wish more men were coming out to stand up and support.
Definitely. This story's kind of buried a few others, but, you know, recently within the critical community, Andy Signor, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, from Screen Junkies, who your friend compared me to a few weeks ago, which is kind of...
Just your voice.
Just my voice, I suppose. And Harry Knowles from Ain't It Cool News. Both recently were fired from their positions.
Which, good. Get them out.
Similar conduct, yeah.
Get them out. Get them gone. We don't need it. We don't. Mm. This world is dark and fucked up enough. Let's take care of each other. You know, call shit out. Call it out. Like, and just...
I think that could be one good byproduct of the Trump thing is now it's like, well, we can't... People feel powerless in that position because it's like, we just can't do anything about it. It's not up to us, unfortunately, until we, you know, depending where you lie politically, how you decide to vote on midterms, things like that. That's all we can do. If we can fix things that we do have influence over, the things that we are in our immediate circles.
Yes.
Then we can.
Disgusting monsters like Weinstein and fucking Trump, they are not above the rules. And Trump is going to, it's going to explode in his face.
Might explode in everybody's face.
It might. But, you know, he's not untouchable. No one is. Man, this got depressing.
Yeah.
that's all we need to say about it.
I think we're good.
Yeah.
We just wanted to acknowledge it because to not say anything about it would be kind of weird.
Yeah.
And do have an opinion on the matter.
Especially when we're saying men need to speak up about it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not even in the industry, but. Fuck right. You, Harvey Weinstein.
Okay, let's get into Blade Runner 2049, which, can I say just off the top, the only opinion I want to give out without getting into the actual movie itself, I hate that fucking title.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's so... we might get into, like, I guess the box office disappointment or whatever, but I think that's a huge part of it. Blade Runner 2049 sounds like a bad, like, early 90s Dark Horse spinoff Blade Runner tie-in. It's nondescript, it means nothing, it says nothing about the movie, and I don't remember it.
You see, I don't mind it. I think it's better than Blade Runner Rise of the Blades. Blade Runner Evolution of Runnings.
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner Rise of the Evolution of Blades Running. Like,
it doesn't have to be some. I would have been fine with Blade Runner 2 even. Or even.
Yeah, what happened to 2? What happened to the number 2?
It's just not cool anymore. Unless you're like a really. Schlocky horror film. Nobody wants to do just like even Roman numerals. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, let's go back to. I mean, Blade Runner 2049 didn't bother me, but Blade Runner 2 would have been fine.
Would have been perfectly fine. All right, so this is directed by Denis Villeneuve. He's a French-Canadian director of films I liked a lot. Arrival last year, Sicario, and Prisoners. He's really been just on a hot streak lately as a director, and he's, earned his place amongst, the big directors doing big Hollywood sequels pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And for good reason. This is a sequel to the, Ridley Scott film from 1982, cult film, cult favorite. Not a lot of people saw it back then. It was not a huge success, but it found an audience 10 years later when it sort of was recut and put into the art houses.
Recut again.
Yeah, with every successing DVD release, there was a new cut, it seemed like. It takes place in the future. The first one was based on a Philip K. Dick story, short story, about a future in which there are these replicants, kind of like clones, kind of like robots, more like clones, and they have a shortened lifespan, and Harrison Ford, who played a detective named Deckard, was on the hunt for them, hired by the government to sort of kill rogue replicants. And now we've jumped into the future, I guess.
The year 2049, to be exact.
Our Blade Runner that we're following this time is Ryan Gosling, who says here K on IMDb, but he goes by Joe at one point in the film.
Mm-hmm. Because he's a replicant.
No questions about it. There's no ambiguity as to whether or not he's a replicant. And he has been hired to take on this interesting mystery in which we find out that a replicant was able to give natural birth, which is an aberration, which is something that's not supposed to happen. And the police company, LAPD, that he works for in the future, wants to erase all this information. They want it to go away. This could be political upheaval for them, as well as the manufacturers, which is used to be called the... What's the company called now? Because
it's Wallace. It used to be Tyrell.
Yes. The Wallace company... having taken over the Tyrell company, and now they're more focused on using replicants as free labor for farming and food supplies than they are in the free labor and slavery, essentially, of the past. Although we're still seeing quite a bit of that as well. But now there's more replicants than there was before, and they have longer lifespans. They don't die in, you know, whatever it was, 4 years, 4 months. But as he's on this journey trying to find this...
Dude, this is a long recap.
I know. It's a long movie. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's on this journey. He's on an existential journey to find, like, what's the deal with this baby that was born, where it is, who's involved, who's hiding it.
Sum it up. Ryan Gosling is a replicant cop searching for a human-birthed replicant baby. Mm-hmm. Adventure ensues.
Adventure ensues, and he's being hot-tailed by just about everybody.
Yeah. So, what did you think? I have thoughts.
You have thoughts? Okay. I had a lot. This was very stacked. Like, it was pretty impossible for me to go in cold. It was pretty impossible for me to go in without some sort of expectation.
The original Blade Runner, I think, is one of the best sci-fi films of all time, and mm-hmm. it's one of my personal favorite movies.
Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite Ridley Scott films. And, you know, I watched it again in preparation because it's a very pretty simple story, but there's a lot kind of there. And I didn't know exactly what angle this new one was going to take. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be sure that I remembered everything correctly. And it holds up, man. Like 1982. And of course, like, you know, the new DVDs and stuff have been cleaned up and everything. But it still looks good. The production design is still gorgeous. It's still one of, and like endlessly copied, like one of the most influential films. Even this year, we talked about the Ghost in the Shell remake, which owes a whole lot, both the anime and the remake owes a whole lot.
This movie was also a pretty drastic turn for Harrison Ford. Mm-hmm. It was the first time he wasn't playing
a smarmy flyboy.
Yeah, a charming rogue. He's very introverted and moody, and it's just a fucking cool film noir.
Right, yeah. And I think primarily that is what the first Blade Runner is. It's set in a sci-fi setting, but both all in the dialogue, in the production design, in the lighting, it all is hearkening back to 1940s detective films. And this film, I think, much less so. The detective stuff, the noir stuff is still there, but I feel like Villeneuve's sort of take on it is a little bit more grand in scope, a little bit more, a little less about the personal inner struggles about it, and more the sociological implications of everything.
Yeah,
even though both movies tackle those things to different degrees.
Well, you're touching on some of my issues with Blade Runner 2049, Rise of the Blades.
Yeah, I'll say this just to get it out there before you can go into your thing. Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot. I admire it even more than I think I like it. And I think it's beautiful to look at. Again, it's shot by Roger Deakins, who's worked with Villeneuve for the last few films. And I just love looking at movies shot by Roger Deakins. Everyone's saying this year might be his Oscar year. And I think he's done more impressive work elsewhere, but this would be just as good a choice as any.
As far as cinematography, yeah, this movie is gorgeous. Like, this is
beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though the story is a little slow, which I actually think is one of the good things the movie did, was I do like how it's paced. Even though it is a little slow, visually it's so interesting.
Yeah, it keeps your eye on something the whole time. And I was impressed by a lot of it. I wasn't always as engaged as I wanted to be, but I also don't think that that's necessarily what the movie wants me to do. And I also think that the same thing could have been said about the first Blade Runner or newcomers as well. A lot of people, you don't fall in love with Blade Runner the first time you see it. Some people do.
No.
But it's a grower, and it usually takes a few watchings to fully appreciate everything about it. I'm willing to give this movie the same benefit of a doubt that I'm only at about like 70% with the movie at this point, 70-80% with the movie. But I'm willing to think that upon repeated viewings, I could grow to love it in a similar but different way than I do the first.
You've kind of touched on similar feelings as mine. I want to start off by saying I did like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a heaping handful of issues with it. So to me, this, I think it does get a lot of the noir elements of the original. I do agree that it is more concerned with a larger scale issues, but I think it captures the tone of the original really well and style, which is hard to do, I think, nowadays. I think it's very easy to make movies look too modern. And I do think this movie does play with a lot of restraint.
I think this movie's an exercise in restraint almost.
Yes. And I was getting a little worried from some of the marketing, because I remember like there were trailers where there's explosions and they're like, there's going to be a war. And I'm like, I hope not. Like, that's not this movie.
Right.
And that's okay. I feel like this movie, though, it has the visual element, but it lacks some of the poetry of the first movie.
I agree with you a little bit there, yeah.
I feel like this movie, and maybe it's because we're viewing it from the perspective of a replicant, but this movie feels really cold and distant, and the dialogue is sparse in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It's barely even here in this one. And we have almost moments of that. And what I mean by poetry is I'm talking about the way the first movie, you're able to sympathize with these replicants that are villains. They're murderers.
That's, I think, the one thing that really complicates that story. Because otherwise, it's just a detective going around shooting robots. But the fact that you totally understand why these replicants are desperate, it's hard to, like...
Ultimately, at the end of the day, their whole goal is to live, you know, and to, like, get 3 years of life, and they're just looking for a way out. They're, you know, Roy Batty has realized how precious life is, and is just trying to have a little more, and that's so... Again, that's where that poetry comes from. It's so depressing and bleak, but hopeful at the same time. And I feel like this movie kind of flirts with some ideas of, like, you know, what is it to be human, and what does that mean? But it doesn't delve as deep into it as I would have liked, as I think the first one did. And maybe it's just a testament to Rutger Hauer's fucking performance.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically the end sequence where he's chasing Deckard through the abandoned house.
And then he has that monologue, which I guess was not improvised, but he wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just crazy. Which is
pretty killer. It's one of the most, I think, iconic movie monologues.
Right, yeah.
I felt they kind of tried to supplement that a little bit with... One of my biggest issues of the movie is Jared Leto. He kills a lot of things for me. To me, he's melodramatic. He's this mustache-twirling, obvious villain with a god complex that is so two-dimensional, he bores the shit out of me. It's not interesting. I don't care that he's blind and has weird little robot eyes. I'm just get out of my movie.
Now, is this residual Joker beef that's seeping in here? I kind of agree. He didn't kill it for me, mostly because he's really not in it that much.
He feels like it's so two-dimensional that it just drives me nuts. And I feel like the character with a little more nuance could have been good. Like, I feel like Jared Leto is Johnny Depp with, like, at the point where Johnny Depp is now. Like, he didn't build up to Johnny Depp's bullshit. He just is there. To the point where it's like he takes me out of the movie. And, like, it just feels really pretentious and
grandstanding. You're always aware of his choices.
Yeah, and it's just growth. Whereas Ryan Gosling, on the other hand, I don't think it's any shock to listeners that I dig Ryan Gosling. He barely has any dialogue, and he has to convey a lot through very little. And I think sometimes it might fall a little flat in this movie. But for the most part, it comes across. And his robot love interest, that to me was the most interesting thing about this movie.
Agreed. I think the women in this movie really steal the show. You have Robin Wright, who plays his captain, his police captain. She's tough as nails, and she totally sells it.
And that could be a really one-dimensional role.
But
exactly. She plays this sort of archetypical character.
The yelly police chief.
But there's these moments where that breaks, and you're like, oh, okay, she's still a fucking human. Mm-hmm. Whereas I never get that with Jared Leto. It feels so high school acting competition to me.
Right. And it's Ana de Armas who plays his digital girlfriend, which reminded me, there's a lot of stuff in this movie, like the look of the city and some of the technology that remind me a lot of Spike Jonze, Her.
Yeah, I got that. Especially with her character. I mean,
and especially their relationship.
Specifically an AI interface that he falls in love with.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was great.
She's really good. And the scenes between them is my favorite stuff in the movie, probably.
Yeah, me too. And again, I think that just shone a spotlight on how much I did not like Jared Leto.
Right. But I would say the baddie in this movie isn't Jared Leto. What's the actress's name who played the replicant who's like pursuing him?
Yeah, I agree. And I also thought it was awesome that she was a badass.
And yet, really a formative villain, very scary, very not as sympathetic as the villains from the first movie.
The thing. I think she could have been the guy who created the replicants in the first movie was just sort of a dork. Like, you know what I mean? He was just sort of like I just created these robots because I get real lonely.
The toy mate. I love that guy.
Yeah, I do too, because it's such an interesting choice. It's so different, and it feels real to me. It feels like, oh, okay, he is sad and lonely, and that's why he would create all these things. Why the fuck does Jared Leto buy this company? And like, because he's obsessed with being God, boring, snooze. If he had been more of like a stern father figure that had some dimension...
Well, then I think you just would have had Tyrell.
No, I mean,
and the character is supposed to mirror a little bit, but I think
I think you could have played it differently, but
I
didn't ever. That was my problem with the female replicant. I thought her portrayal was good. I just never bought her motivation. I never bought that she wanted to please Jared Leto. It was just like, I just don't want to get murdered because he's awful. Like, I don't know. Yeah, it just.
Can I be completely honest? I never was 100% sure what her motivation was. Like,
exactly.
She just, like, up and got super murderous halfway through the movie, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess you're a villain.
Yeah, and I think...
But I kind of felt like she was only written that way so that there would be a villain.
But, that's what frustrated me, is I felt like there could have been so much more there.
I'm also willing to concede that maybe I missed something there, and that upon a repeat viewing, I'll understand that more.
Sylvia Hoax.
Yes.
Her name was Love, but for some reason they kept calling her Angel.
Oh, okay. I confused her with the prostitute earlier, who I don't know who played that, but she was good too. I get what you're saying there. I think maybe if there is a choice for what Jared Leto represents in this movie as opposed to Tyrell in the first movie, and as opposed to the toy maker of the first movie, I think it might be a comment on industrialization.
Mackenzie Davis.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Mackenzie Davis was the prostitute.
I think there might be a sort of a comment about how, you know, the intentions of this creation has become more and more sort of corporatized and less...
Sure, then make him this fucking corporate dude. Don't make him this weird Jared Leto figure. I don't know.
That's an aesthetic choice, both by the actor and by the director.
And I thought a bad one.
Yeah, you know, what's really sad is apparently Villeneuve originally wanted David Bowie to play the part.
Oh, I know. God damn it, that would have been so good.
I don't know how you get from David Bowie to Jared Leto, but there you go.
Ugh.
I don't
either.
Especially when you know, like, if you can't get David Bowie, you get Tilda Swinton. It's just what you
she,
do.
She would have been 1,000% better.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Jared Leto aside, I still enjoyed this movie. My big problem was that it was so focused on the macro. Mm-hmm. Like, what does this mean to society? And there was even a moment near the end, I don't want to get too into spoilery territory, where I thought the robot revolution was going to come, and I was like, I don't need this. I don't... You know the scene I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. San Diego comes into play more prominently? That's one thing I liked about it, is that we get out of L.A., we see what does this future look like to San Diego, we see what it looks like to Las Vegas.
Yeah,
and
I like that, too. I love the world building. I wish it hadn't focused quite so much on the this is going to destroy the world and maybe focus just, you know, 15% more on this is going to destroy Ryan Gosling's world.
There's a slight difference in the tone, too, and I think this might be a director thing. Mm-hmm. The difference between Ridley Scott in 1982 and Denis Villeneuve now, who I think he has a take on this material that is distinct and his own and... you know, definitely part of his auteur vision, and in continuation with what he's done. But I think he, in general, is a little colder of a director. More of a European sort of approach, even though he's Canadian, but you know what I mean. And I think that this movie comes off a lot more dour than the first one. The first one was dark, and the first one was somber, but there was a lot more of kind of a beating heart to him, a little bit more of an emotional core.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
And this one feels, you're right, it's more detached. It's a little bit more sort of observational.
And I would have just like I said, 10% more of that humanity.
Because when it does it really well. There's a few emotional arcs in this movie that I think work really well.
And it surprised the hell out of me. I did not expect.
Right. The one between Ryan Gosling and his AI girlfriend, that I was always interested in. I think the emotional core between about Ryan Gosling trying to figure out his past and all of that stuff and how it ties into the plot.
Oh, yeah.
Was definitely invested in that. And I liked when the there's a few twists in the movie that are a little obvious, but I also was in for it. I thought that they pulled that off really well. There's another emotional core that, let's just call it daddy issues, less into that. I actually think it's not a surprise to say Harrison Ford's in this movie.
No,
he's on the poster. I don't think he needed to be in the movie.
Yeah, I don't think he needed to be. I wish they wouldn't have marketed it so much with him being in it. Like, I think that would have been better as a surprise, because it's not his movie. It's not about Deckard. It's it's definitely about Joe. I didn't mind that he was in it. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, there's been so much interviews and press about it, making it feel like this was going to be a Ryan Gosling, Harrison Ford buddy sci-fi flick, which I am so fucking glad it wasn't.
Right.
So it didn't bother me, but yeah, I don't think he needed to be in it. Like, it would have been an effective story if his character still existed or not.
Right. I mean, even his place in the plot, I think you could have replaced that with a different character and it still would have been effective.
Or his character could have been dead. You know, it could have literally not mattered.
It really wouldn't have. And his place, I don't know, I kind of feel like it was a... That was the most cynical thing I thought about this movie. Was
his involvement in it. Yeah. On a certain level, I do get it. You know, I do understand why they felt that they needed to bring Deckard back. I didn't totally hate it. It wasn't Jared Leto, so.
Hate Jared Leto.
I hated him.
Duly noted on Jared Leto.
He was bad.
I didn't feel one way or the other about the character. I do agree that somebody else probably could have done more with it, but I kind of feel like it's a pretty minor character.
I don't want him in my movies. So what's your final letter grade?
I'm kind of still struggling with it. I'm because it is quality, you know. I don't want to like shit on it and say it's like, oh, well, this didn't work, that didn't work. Like, this is real movie. The people who went into it and made it both on a screenplay level, on an acting level, on cinematography, it's a real movie. This is quality stuff, and I do think that people should go see it. My feelings about it coming out weren't as positive as I necessarily wanted to. I'm kind of feeling a B right now, but that could change.
I feel the same. I agree. My initial grade was a B minus. I do want to see it again. I really enjoyed the visual language. I think it could have used a little more emotional language, and some of the dialogue was a little stilted. And again, when you're coming from a movie that has Roy Batty's death monologue, his own eulogy, it bothered me that this movie didn't care a little bit more about the actual dialogue, you know?
I felt like the first one, and maybe this is just like a CG thing, the first one had a little bit more tactility to it, too. Like, even though the production design here is gorgeous and really cool, like, the first one had this whole, like, Chinatown thing going on, and, like, it was rainy, but it also, like, you know, there was more extras in the scenes. Like, it felt like the city was really alive. And here, it felt a little bit more like we're in kind of a dreamy, like, ethereal world. And maybe that just has to do with the future that they're trying to create here, that this is how it's changed from since... whatever it was, 2016, 2018.
Sure.
And maybe that's what the vision that they had for how that world progressed. But I felt like this was a lot more of a movie universe, whereas the first one, I was a little bit more transported, even though, you know, it was made in 1982.
Yeah. No, I agree. So overall, I thought it was good. I do hope people go see it, because I think it's, they marketed this movie very poorly, and I don't even know if they knew who they were marketing it to.
Well, and people are acting really surprised that this movie underperformed. It's like, you guys, this is a sequel, 35 years sequel to a movie that flopped, that is rated R, that is three hours long.
Which all of these things are good.
But I don't know how the fact that it did as well as it did is actually kind of amazing.
Yeah. So I think people should go see it. I have seen like Facebook comments and stuff. You know, people saying this is their favorite movie of the year.
I know. That's what's so crazy. It's like, I was like, I can't expect the best. I can't expect the worst. I just have to go into it. I almost wish I had seen it before the glowing reviews poured in.
Yeah, because I don't think it's tricky. I don't. That's all I can say is.
I think it's just that there's so few blockbusters with this amount of substance.
Yeah, and I think most people don't go to see. You know, they. You're right. There's not a lot of movies with this kind of budget, with this kind of.
Well, it's what Villeneuve does. He makes these high-budget art films, and he's one of the few that can.
Yeah, I'm a little worried that his detachment from his characters, because I kind of felt this in Arrival, too. I'm a little worried that he's going to get bigger and bigger visually to the point where his detachment from his characters leaves me in M. Night Shyamalan kind of feeling.
Well, I don't know if it'll get there, because he's like, but
you know what I mean.
I know what you're saying. It's actually kind of very similar to what happened to Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
Like, Ridley Scott, you know, he started out, he always had a visual language that was very much his own, and he had a slickness that was very unique for his time, but, like, you know, compare Alien to Alien Covenant.
Right.
Sicario and Prisoners isn't like that at all. It's you're very involved with the characters.
I haven't seen Prisoners, but so far Sicario is my favorite of his.
Me too. All right, let's go on and get into Baskin.
All right.
I will let you bask
in the glory.
this was your homework for our Netflix homework last week.
Yeah. So and a little bit of a shout out to podcast that I know is never going to hear this. The reason I even knew about this movie was because they talked about it on last podcast on the left.
Oh, okay.
And not in depth. It was like a, you know, sort of their opening banter moment, and one of them had watched it, and I was like, oh, that actually sounds really fucked up and interesting.
Sure. Yeah.
So this is a Turkish horror film. For the 2015, it's about a group of cops that they're kind of this rough and tumble crew. They get called out on they get some kind of a call. You don't really know what it is.
To investigate a house or something.
Yeah, to investigate this area that is kind of has kind of a spooky reputation. And then they go to it, and it may or may not be a portal to hell.
Yep.
Yeah. So this movie was fucking weird and gross.
It was again, both of those things.
If you follow me on Twitter, you could have gotten my immediate reactions to it.
I saw them. I hadn't seen it yet when you were doing your live tweeting. So I read them after. And it was funny. It wouldn't have ruined the experience. You didn't give away any spoilers, but
I try not to when I do this, like when I watch a movie and like, that's not my goal. My goal is just like to sort of capture my reaction.
Sure.
And there was some great stuff to react to in this.
Sure. Yeah.
So let's break it down. What did you think?
I assume this is probably your viewing experience as well, but correct me if I'm wrong. I had a little bit of a hard time getting into it for the first third. It's not very long. It's only an hour and a half, which I prefer from most movies, including horror movies, especially maybe. You're kind of introduced to these very unlikable characters. These police characters, they're kind of bro-ish. They're kind of sexist. They're kind of obnoxious.
Oh, they're very obnoxious and gross.
Yeah.
They're very most of them. Well,
which comes, it's done for a purpose. You later find out there's a method to the madness here. It's not just he wanted to give you annoying characters for the sake of being annoying.
And it wasn't just cannon fodder either. It wasn't just, we're going to just introduce characters that you don't like just so they can get slaughtered. Yeah, there's definitely a message.
There's a thing here. The movie sort of unfolds, and it sort of blossoms as it goes. I was getting shades of the sort of dream logic of something like David Lynch's Lost Highway or Jacob's Ladder, which we talked about earlier. This sort of breaking of reality.
Especially once they get into the more hellish stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. Because Jacob's Ladder, for people who don't know, was largely influential for the visual language of the Silent Hill video games.
Right, yeah.
And this is totally reminiscent of that. Because sure. Once that... It's sort of like an Alice in Wonderland story, where except Wonderland is literally hell.
Right, yeah.
But I agree. I think we spent a little too long in the real world with nothing happening.
Well, I think it earns that stuff. It takes a while to get to where it's going, but I think we kind of had to get there with those characters, especially as the timeline starts and to fracture and you start to question what's real and what isn't.
And I'm also willing to admit there might be a little bit of a cultural and language distance.
Sure, yeah.
That might have made it a little harder for me to get to relate to the characters at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because, when at the beginning I am trying to figure out a sense of place and a sense of that kind of thing and time period, and I don't really know that, and I'm not very familiar with Turkey or because it felt a little odd that it was a squad of what was it, like four or five dudes in a van. I've never seen cops like that except for SWAT teams, so you know what I mean.
Right.
So I will concede that there might have been a little bit of a distance from me with the characters at the start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. And
the movie doesn't do anything to really help bring you in. There's sort of one character that's our Cypher character that is the most relatable.
I think once the rubber hits road, literally, then it's a lot easier to kind of get into. And as far as on a genre level, it might not be easy for regular moviegoers to...
Oh, yeah, because there's some...
To take in what's going on, because it's... Yeah, I mean... This is non-American horror, so it's an extreme horror movie, and you have to have a high tolerance for gore, torture, mutilation, rape, all of the above. It goes there on all fronts. It doesn't hold back. It's pretty gruesome stuff, but I think it is done fairly artfully. I mean, there is a decent amount of exploitation going here as well, but I think the combination of exploitation and art is pretty blurry. In a good way.
And it's not like an Eli Roth Hostel kind of thing where
it never feels dumb. It never feels like it's just getting off.
Yeah, it's never gore just for the sake of gore. It is always it's trying to create this nightmare scenario. Mm-hmm.
It's a fully realized nightmare world. I love the production design. I love the way it's the hellish stuff looks. It's similar to Jacob's Ladder in some ways, but even kind of more so. Also, I'm getting some Hellraiser-y, Clive Barker-y vibes.
And a little bit of just some good old-fashioned Rob fucking zombie.
Yeah. What? Yeah. It's a gory film. I also kind of got the circular plot. I don't want to give away anything, but it has a cool ending, and it has a sort of almost sort of short story vibe to it, that something like The Descent.
Yeah, and also the sodomy demons kind of reminded me of the creatures from The Descent.
Mm-hmm. I get why horror people love this movie. This is a if you're a horror fiend and a gore hound and you've seen everything and you just need it, you just need more of it. This is gonna scratch that itch.
Yeah, you could definitely do worse.
You could definitely do worse. But I don't think this is for the faint of heart. I don't think this is for a casual horror fan. If your idea of like a horror film is like the It movie or Conjuring or, you know, a Paranormal Activity or something like that, that's what your idea of like horror is, this is going to challenge that.
And that's why I wanted to start with this. When you were like, mm-hmm. October, we're doing horror and horror adjacent Netflix stuff. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, let's just dive in.
Let's do it.
Let's not,
jump in the deep end.
This does it. Yeah.
You always put a caveat when you talk about horror about not being a gore hound or not being necessarily into horror for its own sake.
Mm-hmm.
Given that, because I think this is sort of a horror movie's, a horror fan's horror film.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel distance from it? Did it ever go too far for you? Did it scare you ever?
It didn't scare me. Mm. Because I think part of it is due to the sort of the dream logic. Like the breaks in storytelling continually reminded me this isn't real, this is a movie, and there is plenty of the main character questioning, is this real? Is this, am I insane? What's going on? And so that makes it a lot harder for a movie to scare me. The movies that scare me are like The Strangers, where it's just a group of psychopaths doing psycho shit for no reason because...
Really?
Yeah. Oh.
You know what's weird? Like, strangely enough, like, that should be the thing that really gets to me. But if we're just going on visceral scares alone, I'm much more scared of, like, the, like, ghosty shit than I am...
Ghosty shit freaks me out too.
Depending on how it's played. I mean, that, you know, all there's exceptions to everything. But the idea of like something you have no control over, like something you can't do anything about is a lot scarier to me than like, cause even like with the idea of a serial killer, that's scary, or like someone who comes through your window in the middle of the night. That's scary, but that is something that you can try to prevent, and B, do something, you know, you can fight, maybe.
Not usually. I mean, it depends. But,
or maybe I'm just, like, more numb to that as a fear because it is a reality, so we just have, you just have to kind of accept it or something?
I think it also just depends on how it's done. Like, The Strangers freaked me the fuck out. Your Next didn't.
Right.
And
that one's a lot more, like, postmodern and clever and stuff.
Sure. But you know what I mean. So it does depend. As far as this goes, I felt like the gore and the horror was really earned. It doesn't just come at you nonstop. So the gore didn't bother me. It was definitely a build to it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fucked up. And again, there was this weird sort of bestiality element, I'm not sure how I felt about it, but it never felt out of place, so...
No, I mean, we're talking about hell.
Yeah. It did a little at the beginning when he was just telling this story. It was like... And that might have been the culture... Part of that cultural misunderstanding. I was like, that's a weird... Like, when he's talking about fucking chickens, I'm like, that's a weird thing to say.
Yeah, I don't think that might be a culture thing. I feel like that was thematic. Because I don't... It's hard to talk about it without getting into spoilers, but, there's questions as to, you know, when they stepped into this and when they were out of it.
Yes, and that's... So it made sense once we get to the end of the movie, but at the beginning I was like, what the fuck? Like...
Right, yeah.
Who talks like that? The gore and the horror, it all felt...
Of a piece.
Yeah, it all felt like it worked together. So, and that's... Okay. And I don't like jump scares. I don't like dumb scares.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're building to something and you're telling a story, I'm going to be a lot more forgiving.
I don't think there is any jump scares in this movie. Not really. I mean, there's a few kind of shocks in this movie, but I think it's a lot more. There's this one quote that I heard from somewhere, and I don't know where or who it was quoting, but it says something to the effect of some famous horror director, it might have been Romero or something, somebody like that, said, if you can't scare them, shock them, and if you mm-hmm. can't shock them, just gross them out. And I yes. and I think this movie maybe does all three.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I liked it. I dug it. I thought the tone was cool. Like I said, it's gross and weird, and that's kind of all I wanted out of a Turkish horror film.
There's also, like, I described last year my favorite movie of 2016, The Witch.
The Witch?
The Vivitch.
The Vivitch?
By Robert Eggers. I described that as sort of a black metal horror film.
Yeah, this movie's metal as fuck.
Yeah, this is, again, sort of heavy metal filmmaking. I would describe this more as sort of a Cannibal Corpse death metal movie.
Yeah, I get that.
In fact, there are scenes in the movie that look like a Cannibal Corpse, right out from a Cannibal Corpse record cover.
Well, that's kind of what I meant when I said Rob Zombie. Like, that's...
Right. The viscera.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked it.
I also thought there was a cool... it was cool how they used kind of folklore to
mm-hmm.
develop this hell. It didn't feel like a Christian interpretation of hell. It felt more like a morality lesson.
Yeah, it felt more Chaucer. It felt more
yeah,
Dante.
Like like these are naughty characters who wander into the woods and get punished for it.
Right,
for...
and there's again like the whole of Clive Barker thing. There's sort of an S&M element to it. The hell is very sexualized.
Yeah, and you get the symbolism with like the plague of frogs and the strangers they meet in the woods. Mm-hmm. It felt very much like a fucked up fairy tale, and I dig that.
Yeah. What's the name of the weird looking actor who played kind of like the ringleader of the demons? Because he is a face for horror films.
Yeah, I called him. I didn't say this on Twitter because I thought maybe this is too harsh, but I called him old baby fetus Jim Norton. I was going to call him old fetal alcohol syndrome, Jim Norton.
He has a look. And it reminded me a lot of the big fellow, the weird looking big fellow from The Hills Have Eyes.
It kind of reminded
me. Found somebody who just is crazy looking. And they're like, you'll do.
It kind of reminded me of the one sister from Freaks.
Oh, yeah. They were the Todd Browning movie.
Yeah, like, just a very strangely shaped
person.
Ted, and...
Yeah.
It looks like a buff old baby man.
And it works. Like, it's otherworldly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is that bizarre stuff, to look at.
Like, I like this movie. It's culty, and it is for a very specific audience. But I think if you are of that audience, if you're a gorehound, if you're a horror movie fanatic, you're gonna like this movie.
Yeah, I agree. It was cool. It never felt dumb or pandering, and sometimes that's what I expect with low-budget horror movies, so.
The movie I want to watch next week, or have you watch...
Also, before we get into that, I just want to say that some people had either already watched the movie, and I got some funny Facebook comments off my Twitter storm.
Yeah.
And I got someone to actually watch it, so... I'm curious to what you thought. If you do end up singing Baskin, 31 Flavors of Hell, send us an email, please. I'm dying to know what you thought of it.
Yeah, the movie I'm going to have you watch next week is Michael Haneke's Funny Games, the U.S. version.
Oh, that's one you've been trying to get me to watch for a long time.
Yeah. Michael Haneke is one of the world's greatest auteurs, and this is a movie that almost nobody likes, except for the people who really like it.
Okay. I have a feeling this movie might freak me out more than Baskin did.
There's a lot to talk about with this movie, and, you know, the only thing I'll say about it before you see it is that he had made the film in French or Belgian originally, and then a couple years later, and you know, to which it was like booed and you know, serious complaints and terrible reviews from just about everybody in France. When he went to Cannes with it. And so he said, well, you know what? I think I'm going to make the exact same movie, shot for shot, but in America. and it came out, actually, I think maybe the same year The Strangers was released, which is interesting as well.
All right. That was one thing I will say about Baskin is I'm not huge on remakes and things like that. I feel like there could be an American audience if they like. I feel like if you got the right director and the right people to be in it, mm-hmm. That it could translate pretty well to Americans.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot there that's so culturally specific that you couldn't do. I actually think I was even thinking of a director, but now I forgot.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So that's what we'll do next week, and that's it for this week's podcast. If anybody has anything to say about anything we said, you can email us at jabberthedrone@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. Follow me individually at BC Cassidy, V as in Victor, CCASSIDY. And follow Keith so you can watch him live tweet the Netflix homework when he does decide to watch it. So what's your Twitter?
It's at Keith Foster Kid. I try to give a little bit of notice, but usually I just start watching it. Mm-hmm. But it'd be fun if people watch the movies with me.
Sure.
If you can't, I understand. Like I said, I don't give a lot of notice, but yes, follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter, at Keith Foster Kid on Instagram. We've only got a few episodes left of Tonight in San Diego. So we do live tapings every Monday. It's a late night talk show in the vein of Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Fallon, that kind of thing. That highlights all the cool things in San Diego. Check it out at tonightinsandiego.com.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's all I got for now.
That's all you need.
Hopefully I got some more stuff coming soon, but we'll see.
I do movie reviews as well for the Idaho State Journal that I post on my blog, saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also see there's content I provide for the Seattle-based website, which I haven't done in a while, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. We have friends who do podcasts that you should also be listening to that include Patrick at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational, which you will be doing a Make Dad Read Comics episode this month, won't you?
I won't. I guess Dad had some issues come up. I don't know how much Patrick wants to me to talk about that.
Okay.
But we're going to be postponing probably for about a month or so.
Okay.
So I will be doing it. It's just going to be a little longer than we thought.
I think you're the Matt Damon of Make Dad Read Comics.
I would love nothing more than to be that. want to do it.
If anyone knows about the Matt Damon Jimmy Kimmel gag.
Also, I want to give a little bit of a shout out to a new listener we got recently. He has his own podcast. Check out Adam Connie's podcast, The Adamant Podcast. I will be guesting on that coming up soon. He told me that the movie Norbit is underrated. And mm-hmm. So he wants me to watch it, and I'm going to go on his podcast, and we're going to talk about it. So right. we'll see how that goes.
All right. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Listen to Rod and Denise at The Listening Party. Listen to Denise's solo podcast, The Mascot Diaries. Check out Mike Fallick, who was on last month at Let's Start a Cult.
Yeah, I've been listening to that one now, and it's
kooky.
It's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, and listen to Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast. Those guys just keep getting better and better. And who am I? I feel like I'm skipping somebody, but I don't think I am.
They did it. Hollywood did it. They gave it to Gosling.
See you later.